Okay, so Jim asked me to talk about planets in peculiar places, and I thought about it a little bit and decided that it is such a great opportunity for me to talk to you about radio detection of exoplanets and what you can do with it, that I will spend part of the time doing that, and then I will address planets in peculiar places just a little bit, remembering that Dimitri will actually do that for us full length and full depth, but like a couple of weeks from now at the meeting. So I suppose that saves the day. So the plan of this talk is to give you the motivation of going into the radio domain in the work on exoplanets, and I will define what is it that can be done and what has been done. And then I will give you some sort of life examples from my own work and the work of people that I've been cooperating with on this particular subject. And I will also briefly talk about white dwarfs. Again, Dimitri will talk about it at length later. And also I will cover planets around neutron stars to some extent. And that part will be what Adam has heard not that long ago. So I'm sorry, it's going to be pretty much the same. Not much has changed. Yeah. Okay, so let's begin with some setup considerations. Not that long ago, about a couple of years ago, at the meeting, a big meeting on brown dwarfs, someone said that radio is king in the studies of or studies of magnetism and structure of low mass stars, really very low mass stars that are commonly used called UCDs or ultra cool dwarfs, and that's basically M7 and beyond, all the way down to massive exoplanets if you want to venture that far. And there's a pretty dramatic illustration of that when you look at the famous diagram, which is called Gödel-Benz diagram, that correlates radio luminosity of active radioactive stars and flares with the X-ray luminosity. So the correlation is pretty obvious. This is just the regular stars here, all the way down to this level, and it's also astrophysically quite understandable. You have beams of particles that heat up, that are generated by magnetism and rotation of a star, and then those beams are visible in the radio, and then they also heat up the chromosphere and the corona of the star, and from there you get X-rays, and so that correlation between the two domains is obvious. But the thing is that when you go beyond roughly there, that correlation breaks down. That is, the X-rays go down, but the radio emission does not. And that is still a little bit of a puzzle. There is really no satisfying explanation of what exactly does happen, but the effect is clearly there. And so what that means is that if you want to continue studying those stars, especially magnetism and internal structure, those two things are obviously physically connected, then going radio makes a lot of sense. You don't really get that much of H-alpha emission anymore. Of course, X-rays go down too. And then those stars are very often or commonly very rapid rotators, and that smears the spectral line. So if you want to do polarization using Zeeman effect, then you're in trouble because of the line broadening. So this just illustrates what I was just saying. You get the magnetic reconnection somewhere down in the magnetosphere of a star, and then in the radio you can actually see what's going on at the site of the reconnection, and then higher up, especially in the corona, you actually see the secondary effect of the reconnection event, which is of course heating up of the corona and X-rays and all that, and then you get the proton flux that hits your planet. That happens, of course, much, much later. But the first signal that something has happened actually comes from radio observations. And here's an illustration of exactly that sort of thing observed at Arecibo on one of the stars that we've been looking at. So that's the motivation, broadly speaking, the motivation.
On this plot, sorry, yes? I can't see the symbols. What are the ones that follow the correlation down to low X-ray luminosities? On the plot above.
This here?
Above plot.
Radio versus X-ray. So this is log LX, X-ray luminosity,
right.
And this is radio luminosity.
There are some points that fall in the correlation at low luminosity and some that don't. What are the differences?
Yeah, those are flares, because it's for flares and active stars.
Okay.
And if you look at just the regular radio behavior and X-ray behavior of stars that go beyond M7, then you veer off. Here, meaning that
the other points that are on the line are flares
from earlier type stars.
From earlier type stars. What's the slope of that red line?
What's the slope? Oh man, I don't remember.
Oh,
no, I've never really.
If it's synchrotron and thermal X-rays, I wouldn't necessarily expect a linear relation.
It is very linear.
It's very linear.
Yeah. I mean, you can see it.
So slow down.
Yeah.
9.7.
Right.
9.7.
Okay. Okay, can you continue?
Is the lower left the measurement of the sun?
The
lower left, is that from the sun?
You mean this?
Sorry, the lower left.
The
Gary plot.
Oh, here. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yes. That's that's the illustration of how it works for the sun. Yes. This is just type 3 bursts and how they look like, and the reverse slope bursts and the symmetric wavelength bursts. And well, this is basically what you also see from time to time, if you're lucky, in stars other than the sun.
I'm still a bit confused. So you're saying that the stars that are on the line are flaring and the ones that veer off are not?
No, it's both. Actually, the stars can be flaring and can be just radioactive. So you see a lot of outbursts that are not big, you know, bright flares, but just radioactivity. So that diagram is for both types of emission that you see.
But the big difference, the ones that are clearly to the left of the line are quite.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. So that's how all that has started, from this observation that this is what happens, and the need to actually go radio when you look at stars, lower mass, rapidly rotating stars. So all that really boils down to detecting the so-called cyclotron maser emission from those stars. The idea here is, one of the ideas, and I guess the one that is kind of leading these days, is that what actually happens is that your star switches from stellar-type radio emission to planetary-type, which is what we observe in our Earth, Jupiter, Uranus, Saturn, basically all those planets in our system that have magnetic fields. And that is that you have solar wind that produces energy in the kinetic or magnetic form that then accelerates electrons toward the polar regions of your planets and produce radio auroras. It's a kilometric radio emission in the case of our Earth, because the magnetic field is very low. It's decametric emission in the case of Jupiter, because the field there is on the order of a few gauss, up to 10 gauss or so. But that is really what we observe. And the good thing about the ECM or ECME is that it's relatively radio bright, because it's a coherent emission. And also because its center frequency, this is actually cyclotron frequency where the emission happens, is directly proportional to the strength of the field that accelerates the electrons. So when you look at the dynamic spectrum of the burst like this, and you actually find the upper, the cutoff, the high frequency cutoff in it. This is not the cutoff, this is actually RFI, so it keeps on going. But if you just find it, then you have measured the strength of the magnetic field at the foot of the line, of the magnetic field line that was active and produced that emission. So that is really a great way, the great way to measure a magnetic field, detect and measure the magnetic field of a star or a planet, if you're lucky to actually detect it. So, because if you just look at the simple dipolar field of, or something of that sort, and the beam of electrons that do this propagate outwards, then obviously, rather than getting a very narrow band emission, which it theoretically is, it gets smeared over frequencies quite a bit. And in fact, the what you see is the combined effect of the beaming of the emission, because the electrons are mildly relativistic in this case, the configuration of your field, which could be a simple dipole, could be multipolar, or you know, it could be some kind of chaotic changing one, and also the viewing geometry. Because of the beaming effect, you really have to worry about how you actually look at your star and how is the magnetic field inclined toward your line of sight. So in principle, looking at the diagrams like this, you could disentangle all this by modeling. It's easy to say, but much, much, much harder to do. And so far, despite of several efforts that have been made, nobody has managed to really do it successfully. There are too many ambiguities in this to be successful easily. But in principle, I'm sure it can be done, and hopefully one day we'll be able to use this as a great tool to diagnose the structure, not only the strength, measure the strength, but also diagnose the structure of the magnetic field of your star or planet. And then, of course, that gets you down into the interior of the star that is of great interest, obviously. So there are, so that is one way to generate that emission and detect it. The other way is the famous Jupiter-Io mechanism, the unipolar dynamo effect, in which you have an obstacle moving in the magnetic field of your star or planet, orbiting obstacle. In the case of Io, of course, its volcanic activity produces plasma that then streams down the flux tube, as it's called in this case, toward the poles, magnetic poles of the star. And from there, you get the decametric cyclotron Maser emission in the form of periodic bursts that have two periods, one of which is the orbital period of Io, and then there's also the emission from the poles of, or auroral oval emission from Jupiter, just like this, which has the period of, equal to the orbital period of, rotation period of Jupiter. I will talk about that a little more later. So that's the general scenario for what happens and what, how to measure, what do you measure and how to measure it.
Alex?
Yes?
Does this require then that you have a very small emitting region? Or, you know, the flare happens in a very small place so that you have a compared emission as opposed to the flare? Or is the direction of the
Not necessarily, because you actually have, you're talking about the Jupiter Io thing? Yeah, so it actually happens around the pole. Around the pole, and then the electrons go up along the from the foot or feet of the magnetic field lines, anchored somewhere up there. The electrons stream up the field and emit in the radio, which actually produces this smear in frequency, because the frequency here, magnetic field strength gets lower and lower as you go up.
But is the fact that it's highly polarized means that it has to be in a, I mean, it sounds like it has to be very directional.
Right? Oh, yes, absolutely, yes.
Does that alone tell you that it's a very small...
Yes, there's that, and also there's a beaming effect. So from the duration of a flare, you cannot tell right away how large is the region, because there's the beaming effect, which you can actually see here in this slight flaring of the flare, is also important. But both the size of the beam and the size of the region have to be small. And they're elongated along the active field line. Okay. So more generally, what this is just a list of a number of different things that you can do exploiting the radio observations of low mass stars and planets. So in terms of planet detection, of course, radio is not king, obviously, compared to other methods. But there is this very interesting possibility to use to look for a possible Jupiter Io emission from various kinds of stars, and that includes low mass stars, brown dwarfs, white dwarfs, and also a possibility of planet-satellite interaction, although in this case the intensity of the emission would be really very low compared to stars. And it's still unclear what are the best observing frequencies that to use for this, because they obviously depend on the magnetic field strength of your star. High strength means high frequencies, low strength means low frequencies. Then hot Jupiters and planet interaction due to the stellar wind, I will talk about that here a little bit more. That requires observing at very low frequencies generally. I will tell you why in a moment. Some of those low mass stars and brown dwarfs emit radio flares very periodically, like pulsars, more or less, except that the precision, timing precision here is much, much, much lower. But in principle, you could use that and the variability of timing to detect planetary mass objects around them. And of course, in the case of pulsars, timing is the way to go. It is really super precise. And again, I will address that a little later. The other range of subjects that you can address is obviously monitoring of low mass stars for activity, and that is becoming more and more important because M dwarf planets are now such a hot topic, and there have been detections. There will be a lot more, obviously, than TESS has been doing already. And so looking at those stars, especially those that may end up having planets in habitable zones, does make a lot of sense, because you do want to know how active those stars are because of the obvious issue of related to habitability. And then the detection of magnetic fields, which again relates to habitability and also structure of the planets is another thing, and that is that. And it has been done for many years now, but still solid detection, firm detection of the planet in the radio remains a holy grail in this particular field. The problem is that if you look at existing hot Jupiter systems, then you look at planets and stars that are relatively old, meaning that the magnetic fields that you deal with are low. And because they are low, you have to go to very low frequencies. And at low frequencies, we do have quite a number of very interesting radio telescope or radio arrays, some of them already working, like LOFAR or LWAs, and some in the phase of planning, like HERA and SKA. But still, all of them may be just not enough to routinely detect radio emission from hot Jupiter systems. I will get to that in a moment. Another possibility, of course, is to look at young systems where magnetic fields can still be strong enough to move us to gigahertz frequencies, that is high frequencies, where sensitivity of the existing telescopes is much, much better. At very low frequencies, there are two main problems. One is that the sky background is very, 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 very high. So the sky at very low frequencies is very hot in the radio, and that interferes with your sensitivity to detect things like that. And another, the other thing is the RFI. A lot of radio interference, man-made, that is another big problem.
Can you see this?
Yeah.
So you're saying if you look at young planets, mm-hmm. young stars, it's the stars that, is the planetary magnetic field that you're...
The idea is that the magnetic field of the planet is still strong enough.
In the gigahertz frequencies?
If it's... on the order of hundreds of Gauss, then that gets you up to about a gigahertz radio frequency.
And you would think it would have been that high for planets like the Earth?
No, it would really, no, I'm talking about massive planets. And I will show it to you in just a moment.
Okay.
Something I don't have a good feel for in the top of my head. What is the relative radio brightness?
Sun and Jupiter. Oh, that's orders of magnitude. I don't have the exact figure for that. But Jupiter is really very dim in the radio, and it emits at very low frequencies.
Okay.
In the Sun, you go all over the electromagnetic spectrum.
Oh, sure.
So in the radio, if you put Jupiter right next to the star, to the Sun, and try to sort of direct detect it, as in the case of normal planets, you will be blinded by the Sun.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So why all that is possibly a fun thing to do, or the profitable, useful thing to do? One thing is that detecting exoplanets in the radio would give you constraints on planetary interiors, in addition to what you get from the famous mass radius diagram. And that's because if you detect the magnetic field, then you know right away that there has to be conductive material inside the star that generates the field. And that, of course, is like iron in the planets like our Earth, or hot water in the case of ice giants, and finally metallic hydrogen for gas giants. So that radio detection, or any detection of the magnetic field of a planet, gives you this additional constraint. And so I would think that turning the mass radius diagram into mass radius magnetic field diagram would be actually very, very useful for the way we interpret the interiors, or try to figure out the interiors of the planets from observations. Another...
Alex, doesn't it also depend on the rotation?
Well, the one thing that's behind all this is that you do need to have those objects rotating fast enough. That's clear, very clear. And I should have said that at the very beginning. So all that is under the assumption that you are looking at an object that is rotating rapidly enough to be able to generate the field. How exactly, that's of course another story. And then of course constraints on habitability, that is, I think, the main interest in main motivation for trying to detect exoplanets in the radio. And all this is really pretty obvious to all of us, again, adding one more dimension to all the habitability depictions or representations, which would be the detection or non-detection of the magnetic field, or proving that there is no substantial magnetic field in the planet, is very important. And again, all that can be done in principle by detecting cyclotron Maser emission from exoplanets, as I discussed it a little bit earlier. So what is our thinking about all this? The way it has been done so far for many years at very low frequencies with the available radio instruments is that you, rather than, I would say conceptually, it's like taking Jupiter and moving it very close and making it from Jupiter to hot Jupiter. And so having a planet like that close to the star, exposed to its magnetic field at a very short distance, magnifies the radio emission, or the interaction between the two objects, to the point that the radio emission from the auroral oval of your planet could be very bright, as opposed to Jupiter. If you take Jupiter and move it to interstellar distances, say a few parsecs or something, you will never see anything. But in the case of a hot Jupiter, it's a different story, and the magnification or amplification of the emission that you can detect is orders of magnitude. So the way it has been studied, there has been a number of different ways to do this, but people were just looking at the cyclotron Maser emission from planets in the solar system, from our Earth all the way over through Uranus, Neptune, and then Jupiter and Saturn also from Cassini. Cassini has actually detected long wavelength radio emission from Saturn very, 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 very nicely, and then extrapolated to the hot Jupiter zone, which would be in this range, calculated range of the incident magnetic power available. And so, and then from this, you can actually calculate the expected radio fluxes from hot Jupiters, assuming the mechanism, that the same mechanism as operates, which operates in our solar system, would do it out there, which is actually a very reasonable or obvious assumption. Now, what Jake Turner did was a very interesting experiment to illustrate this, which was to go to LOFAR, look at Jupiter with LOFAR at 60 or 70 megahertz or so, very, very low, very low frequency, and then take the data and mess them up in the sense that he added a lot of noise to the data, pretending that Jupiter was actually emitting from the distance of 5 parsecs rather than very, very close in, right, in the solar system. And that experiment produced a very chilling result. Certainly not totally pessimistic, but rather chilling, which is that for the average radio emission of Jupiter looked at from the distance of 5 parsecs, you would have to have the sensitivity going up by the factor of about 10 to the fifth, and for in order to be able to see it from there. And then for peaks, that is the bright outbursts that Jupiter also has, you would see them from the distance of about 20 parsecs if amplified by the same factor, 10 to the fifth. So that's not too good. And that explains why, so far, despite a lot of efforts, nothing has been found. So we have thought about that and decided that perhaps looking at planets that are still...
What was that one point in the upper right of the diagram?
That's a star. That is one of the... That is the binary star that provides an illustration that the scaling is more or less right. The idea is that rather than looking at old systems and hot Jupiters that are old and therefore have low magnetic fields, you could actually look at the directly detected exoplanets that are still young and hot enough that assuming rotation that is rapid enough, they could have magnetic fields in the range that would translate into radio frequency range that would make the stability of that emission much more practical. So that is the work by Ansgar Reines and Christensen from quite a few years ago. They actually produced scaling that is quite useful and kind of, if real, it demonstrates that if you take a planet that is about 10 million years old, and there are quite a number of planets like that already detected, and look at an object which is, say, 10 Jupiter masses or so, that takes you to magnetic fields on the order of a kilogauss, or just below, or perhaps a little bit above. And that, assuming cyclotron Maser emission, translates to the detection frequencies above 1 gigahertz or so, which is good because of those frequencies, the sky is relatively cool, telescopes are big and sensitive, and Miljansky fluxes or something like that, which are not detectable at very low frequencies, are easily detectable at high frequencies. So this is the idea. We have tested it looking at brown dwarfs that are just as cool or just as hot as hot exoplanets, that is a few hundred degrees Kelvin or so. So that takes you down to T dwarfs and below that. And the idea was just to see, basically say, if we can detect objects like that, brown dwarfs like that in the radio, then possibly extrapolating to massive exoplanets, we could do that too, assuming that they're young and hot and still have high magnetic fields. So we have actually detected the first radio-emitting T dwarfs, which was T65, and that was really quite a surprise because that thing, the temperature of that thing is 900 degrees or so, and still sporadically, but quite surely, it does emit radio flares from time to time. And then that produced more detection by Greg Hallinan group, Melody Cao, and a lot of different people. And then we also found another one. And so that, to us, is a proof of the concept that we could go for young, hot exoplanets and try to detect them in the radio. So far, it has not happened. It's a developing story. But, well, maybe that's the way to go. We'll see.
The plot on the upper left, the lines are showing the magnetic field strength of the ground dwarfs over time. What's the shaded region?
That's our sun, the evolution of of the magnetic field of our sun. So that's one solar mass star. Okay, so if you want to learn more about all this, of course, there's no time to go into it, all the gory details of the whole process. We had a very nice meeting on the subject a couple of years ago. And looking at the talks that are still online from that meeting might be interesting. Also, that provided motivation for a larger group of us to produce two white papers, one for the Science Committee on Exoplanet Science. And on exoplanet science, and then the other one for the decadal survey. So those are also online. So please take a look at them if you are so inclined. Where am I? Okay, now an illustration of how all that works for low mass stars. Here is the proxy that we've been using that. Well, for people who work in this field, this is a very well-known star. It has been studied to death by people for many years now because it has all the nice properties that you want to have it emit in the radio. One is it is a very, very rapid rotator, just under 2 hours. It is at the very bottom of the main sequence. It is many other stars like that, but this one emits in the radio, actually, over a large range of radio frequencies periodically at that period, and so regularly that you can actually time it over some periods of time with the precision on the order of 1 second, which is actually pretty good, to the point that you could use that to try to detect planets around it using the radio timing method. I've tried that, but it didn't produce anything. And then it also has the sinusoidal variation at the same period in the near infrared and optical. Same period is seen in linear polarization, and then Peter Williams detected it not that long ago with ALMA. So it's really a star that is all over the place and very useful to actually look at. So we looked at it over a period of 1 year, sort of semi-regularly, and here is what we got. So what we are looking at is the times of radio emission, or times of the flares that we observed, as a function of the rotation period, which is just in phase here. That's the rotation period of the star, so this is 2 hours. And time, just about 1 year worth of observing. And you can see that for about 4 months, at the beginning of our observations, the emission was all over the place. The star was ridiculously active and unexpectedly active because we thought it would be doing this. Instead, it was really very chaotic and all over the place. And then within the period of, I guess, a week or a couple of weeks or so, there are no dense observations here, unfortunately. It just stopped doing this and switched back to this planetary type emission, which is the emission from the auroral oval that gives you periodic pulses once every rotation period. And then towards the end of it, I think it started to get back to this, but that was the end of observations and no more data. And in terms of the intensity, at the time of the switch, there was also the spike in the luminosity of those flares, which may also be causally connected to what happened here. So one idea here is that the star actually switches from time to time between this planetary type of radio emission and the stellar type of radio emission, which is basically active regions all over the place. So that is one possibility. Another possibility is that actually it has a planet that is engaged in the unipolar dynamo process. And so sometimes when the planet that supplies electrons into the field of the star runs out of juice for whatever reason, then the star happily does the planet type of radio flaring. But when the planet is active, then of course it's getting it gets quenched, and the emission is seemingly all over the place. But if you fold it modulo the orbital period, you should be able to see the systematic effect. And if you do that, this is just the gallery of flares from that star over the 1 year period, so I will just skip over that. So it should look like this. This is just an illustration of how Jupiter Io effect works. This is just this schematic of it. So you have the planet and then the torus, plasma torus around it, which is aligned with the orbit of Io, and then you have active magnetic field lines that supply electrons onto the polar regions, magnetic polar regions of Jupiter, and then that can be modeled quite nicely. You should get these arc-like features in the dynamic spectra with the right circular and left circular polarizations coming from the north and the south pole, respectively. So here are just examples of those decametric outbursts from Jupiter, and when you take a lot of them, and this is actually the fantastic work that they did over 26 years. So they put all the flares detected over the period of 26 years here in the Jupiter rotation phase, Io orbital phase plane. And you can really see how nicely it works. That is, those vertical smudges here are just emissions from, or flares from, the polar regions of Jupiter. And that obviously correlates with the rotation period of Jupiter. And these horizontal ones are correlated with the orbital phase of Jupiter, because they are coming from the active plasma tubes connecting Io and Jupiter as it orbits around the planet. So this is basically what you would expect from a detection of Jupiter-Io effect generated by a planet orbiting a star, if you're lucky. So we tried that. And here is this is just a comparison of what I showed you right a moment ago and what you do when you fold the TVLM 513 data model of 4.6 day period. So, you know, there is something going on here and here, and this is obviously the star, the planetary type radio emission from the star that you saw earlier. I'm still scratching my head over this, because the problem is that that is Arecibo, meaning that you get data once a day over a two-hour period, and then you go to the next day and you have 2 hours again, and then you go like that on and on and on. And so what's mixed into this is the sidereal period, rotation period of our Earth. And at this point, 4.6 days turns out to be a very low subharmonic of that period, and that's no good. So it looks kind of convincing, but if you think about it, it may actually be our Earth sort of sneaking in with its own rotation. How to disentangle those things, I'm not quite sure. If you have any bright ideas on that, I would be very happy to know. But it's still an ongoing project.
Is it possible a subharmonic in the rotation star as well, or is that?
That too, yes. Sure. So it's actually quite complicated and dangerous in the sense, because you can lead yourself to believing that you've done something really exciting and in fact you have not. Okay, so that's that. that's where that project is. Now, just a few words about white dwarfs. We all know that how exciting that field has become, and how many different means to detect planets or planetary debris around white dwarfs have become available, including of course the historically earliest metal pollution of the spectra, and then the transit detection of the orbiting debris, and then a bigger piece of debris or planetesimal or something like that causing calcium lines to fluctuate at the period, the rotation or orbital period of that thing. Then also, what is perhaps a little bit less known, there have been serious attempts to detect planets around white dwarfs, looking at white dwarf oscillations and timing them. So this is actually the project that has been published by this group quite a while ago, and it looked kind of exciting for one of those DA dwarfs that have oscillations stable enough to be able to do that. But it turned out that this variation was visible in only one of the oscillation modes of that star, not all of them, which you would expect if you were looking at the Keplerian signal. So unfortunately, it didn't work. But potentially, this is the way to detect Jupiters around DA white dwarfs or any white dwarfs that actually have oscillations stable enough to give you the order of 1 second or a few second timing precision. So another way to do this that has been suggested in the 90s by Willis and Wu is to go back to what I was just discussing, which is the Jupiter-Io Io effect. And that would certainly should work, especially for magnetic white dwarfs, and we know how many of them are really highly magnetic. And there we are talking not kilogauss fields, but megagauss fields, which takes you to very high radio frequencies if you wanted to make detections like that. They proposed it. Nobody has really done it. And we've been thinking about launching a project to try to add Jupiter-Io or unipolar dynamo effect to the various means to detect planets or planetary debris around white dwarfs. And I've asked Dmitry to help me with this, and we'll see. I mean, on the conceptual level, theoretical level, we'll see what's going to happen. But I think it's kind of exciting to go that way. And finally, the last few minutes or so on neutron star planets. So I kind of like to start with this comparison picture, which is pulsar planets, that is two super Earth planets and a moon-like one orbiting a neutron star, and one of the famous Kepler systems. That is just an illustration of what Kepler has been finding so abundantly, which is the tightly packed resonant super Earth systems. And interestingly, this is really a preview of that. This is exactly that sort of thing. That is two planets in two to three resonance, and all three kind of tightly packed into a little system. Of course, 25 years ago or so, if you said that this was really like previewing what's going to happen 20 years later, nobody would believe that, but it did happen. Another thing that was interesting from the beginning about the neutron star planets was that the very existence of a system like that sort of suggested that planets should be very common around all kinds of stars, including very peculiar places. I'm again quoting from Jim, because that was his peculiar places thing. And indeed, that is exactly what has happened. So what is the status of work on this? Here is just a comparison of the timing data taken until 2008. Then myself and the group I was working with stopped doing this, because when we submitted yet another proposal, Arecibo proposal, to continue this, one of the referees asked a very valid question, which was, what else can you actually learn from this, continuing this work on and on and on for ages? And I took it seriously and decided that indeed perhaps not much can be done at that level of precision which was available at that time, and we just stopped and went to do something else, which is actually a healthy thing to do from time to time. But then new back-end equipment became available at Arecibo, and also new concepts, what to do with planets around neutron stars came to the surface. And so we started again at the level of precision that was much better than here. So here, the RMS noise, timing noise in the data is about 3.5 microseconds. And here it's only 0.5 microsecond. So it's a very dramatic improvement of timing precision. So we did it for 1 year, for about 1 year, trying to figure out how to find planets around neutron stars, but in the part of the parameter space, which would include very tight orbits and very low mass objects, which kind of suggested that doing high cadence observations would be the best and most sensitive way to do it. So on the bottom panel, what you actually have is not the timing residuals from this sophisticated timing model, but the variation of the column density of electrons over time. It's called dispersion measure. That's a unit that we use to parameterize that. And it's very important that you track it and correct for it, because that causes the frequency-dependent time delays in the data. So you have to correct for it. Same thing here. That's for this data block taken recently. And these wiggles here are real. I mean, the error bars here are really little tiny. And that is important, as I will try to demonstrate to you in a moment. So the idea behind that experiment was to verify that we can actually get enough sensitivity to look for planets in, as I said, in this part of the parameter space, that is low mass planets. So this is actually calibrated, this axis is calibrated in moon masses. It's not Earth masses or Jupiter masses or anything like that. That is the precision that you get in pulsar timing. You can get down to really large asteroid masses. So another way to say that, to people who are more accustomed to thinking in terms of radial velocity precision, is that here we are not talking tens of centimeters per second. We are talking millimeters per second. This is the equivalent precision that we get from timing of the millisecond pulsars. So it actually shows that with 0.5 microsecond precision that we sort of demonstrated to be possible for the existing pulsar planet system, or the pulsar that has planets around it, you can really get into this region and try to find planets like that. That has to do with the idea that if the supernova fallback mechanism, as one of the examples of possibilities to make planets around neutron stars, is at work, then you don't get much mass and you also get very compact disks. And so that would lead up to low mass planets on very quick orbits. Pulsar timing has, just like astrometry, is less sensitive for in this part of the diagram as opposed to radial velocity, meaning that when you go for longer and longer periods, you get better and better sensitivity to the detection of low mass planets. So here you really need all the sensitivity you can get to do this, and that's Arecibo. And possibly in the future it will be FAST, the 500 meter Chinese telescope that is now coming up to speed. So just trying to exploit the data that we took with this enhanced timing precision, we also looked for a possibility that there are more very low mass planets in that system in addition to the existing moon mass object. So this is the Lohm-Scarbel diagram calibrated in terms of orbital period versus mass. You can do that quite easily assuming circular orbit. So here's the planet A, the moon mass planet, after having removed the big super Earth planets from the data, from the model, or fitting them out. That's probably the right way to say it. And then if you remove this one also, then the blue line shows what's left over, and there's really nothing there down to the fraction of the mass of the moon. So, you know, that system is probably clean in that sense, except for a possibility for an asteroid belt, which could contribute to the noise here. That's yet another very interesting part of this whole story of planets around neutron stars that I'm not going to touch now. We obviously have no time for this. So the last thing that we looked at was the Keplerian residual. So this is just the data from that year and a half or so, without removing planets from it at all. So that obviously creates a large Keplerian signal, which is just the two planets close to 3-2 resonance beating against each other. This is just like radial velocity data, except that this is time, not velocity. And this is the variations of Coulomb density of electrons over the same period of time at the same epochs. So here, just to take a closer look at it, I subtracted the polynomial from the data just to get rid of the slow long-term trend. And when you look at what's left over after that experiment, is that there is a significant correlation between the variations of electron density over time and the Keplerian signal. And the correlation is actually 0.6 or something like that. If it were perfect, I would be very worried that something is not being done right in the modeling process. But there is a correlation there. And so that obviously brought back all the excitement from the old days to this whole story, because it suggested that actually the easiest way to explain what's going on is that planets have been slowly being ablated or evaporated by the pulsar beam, by the pulsar wind, which is obviously gigantic compared to stellar winds. So that led to a simple model with the pulsar at the center. These are the orbits of the two planets. And I actually generated the Gaussian model of electron density picked up at the planet and going down to zero, 90 degrees away from the line of sight. And the model, I mean, this is really a very primitive model. You can see it here, the red line. It actually works quite well explaining what happens here. Of course, it can be made much cleaner, more sophisticated. This is just the first shot at it, just to see if it's feasible at all. And it looks like it is. So maybe this is just yet another example of star-planet interaction in the regime that is very different from what we are normally used to, which is the pulsar and its wind slowly ablating, either ablating the surfaces of the planet or maybe evaporating the atmospheres and creating those orbiting bubbles of ionized gas around them. And sort of back of the envelope calculations kind of make sense. The observable that you get here is the amplitude of the variations in Coulomb density of electrons along the line of sight. So assuming the size of the bubble around the planet, you can actually calculate what is the electron density in that bubble. And then if you assume the ionization fraction in that bubble, then you can calculate the mass of the whole thing. So all the numbers that come out of it are reasonable. Again, that's at the very, very preliminary stage of thinking and working on it, but it looks very intriguing, and so I'm not really regretting anymore that I went back to that pulsar and its planets after so many years. So I've been talking almost an hour, so I suppose this is the moment to stop. Thank you very much. But let me just say one more thing, and that's to you, Becky. You may remember I came to your office at some point and asked you about the apparent eccentricity of the orbit of the inner planet in the system that I found in the new higher precision data. And you said, well, maybe the 2-to-1 resonance planet hidden in the system, making the inner planet orbit eccentric. That was the effect that I wasn't really quite aware of. So that's why I went back to see if there are more planets in the system, and I found none. But I found that actually the shape of the orbit of that inner planet was frequency dependent. The shape depended on what radio frequency I was looking at. at it. And that actually tipped me toward this, because then I understood that that eccentricity was not real, but it was just because of the varying delay, timing delay caused by dispersion measure variations. So it was really a good discussion that kind of tipped me in this direction, and now I'm here.
That's
all right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
So Alex, of the 300 millisecond pulsars in the galaxy, how many have been probed for planets in that parameter space that you showed?
None. None. The planets like the super Earth mass ones in that system would have been found very easily by the existing long-term timing programs. But the reason why I've been trying to get into this is the realization that all those programs had zero sensitivity for that particular type of a planet. And maybe this is really what they are, most commonly.
And those asteroid disks that you briefly mentioned that could be in some of these pulsar systems but are just under the noise, I think I remember one of the papers, I think it was Shannon and Cordes.
Yes.
They said that JWST potentially could decrease the noise floor. Is that, but I don't know how much time that would actually require. I don't know how plausible that is, or if that was just sort of speculation.
I think the easier way is to look at the power spectra of the timing residual noise. Because the slope, I mean, if you detect the slope in it, then the slope depends on the architecture of the asteroid belt. So you can infer the presence of asteroid belts from the residual timing residual noise. That, I think, is a rather indirect way to do this, but I think it's better than speculating that JWST is going to do this. I just don't believe it, but you know, believing is one thing and actually doing it is something different. Okay.
Are there any normal pulsars where the timing precision is good enough to find?
Oh yeah, yes. Yes, and it has been done and nothing has been found. Yeah. Which actually set the constraints on the availability or feasibility of the mechanism, supernova fallback mechanism. But there are other ways, like white dwarf mergers and...
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Kind of one proposal is that these are formed and you disrupt a white dwarf and then you have a disk around it and then you can form planets out of that disk.
Yeah.
You think that seems like a plausible, viable...
Story? Well, this guy is single. It is a single millisecond pulsar.
Which is rare.
Yes, it is rare and it's probably telling that... That maybe it had a companion that was destroyed and part of the material from it was used to make those planets.
Is it mildly recycled? What's the spin period?
Let's see, it has a 6.2 millisecond period, so it's a solid millisecond pulsar.
But not,
yeah,
not at the fast end.
No. Yes?
What's the fundamental precision limit due to changes in the shape of pulses or strength of the pulses in function of time?
It's, I would say, tens to hundreds of nanoseconds.
Yeah.
So the nanograph people have actually tested that very well because they really want to get down to nanoseconds to detect those long wavelength gravitational waves. And so from them we know that it is a problem, but it is not so fundamental as it is in terms of, you know, stellar activity versus planets. So there are other very subtle effects like propagation effects of various kinds, not only that, also refraction and diffraction translate into frequency dependent noise at the same level, and you have to very carefully try to take it out. But that's difficult to model. This is easy because you easily monitor it by multiple timing at multiple frequencies. But those effects are harder to take out. Okay, thank you very much.
Actually, I have a follow-up question. The timing precision improvement that you achieved, is that mainly due to bandwidth or?
It's new backend
and
new receivers. That's the Puppy backend, which is the one that is broadband, and that fits or matches the bandwidth of the receiver. That's 800 megahertz. So that helps a lot, but you cannot use it at low frequencies. At low frequencies, I mean, that's only good when you look at L-band, S-band, and even higher. At low frequencies, the bandwidths that you use and used to use in the past are tens of megahertz, no more. So there, it's just the backend itself and the way it removes dispersion. And of course, the upgrade of RSIBO upgrade that also increased sensitivity quite a bit at various frequencies. So it's a lot of different factors working together. Okay, I'm turning off. Thank you.